When you celebrate science, perhaps it's best to not get carried away. The inauguration ceremony included some, how should we put it, original choreography.
It was quite bizarre.
Aida Alami, do you associate this kind of dancing with the inauguration of a tunnel?
The science journalists you're listening to are commenting on the opening ceremony of the $7 billion technological marvel that is the Gotthard Tunnel in Switzerland. Here's another report on this ceremony that the Daily Mail called one of the most bizarre opening ceremonies in history.
Dancing construction workers, angels with giant heads, and whatever these things are. It's a surreal ceremony.
Now, if you've read anything about this ceremony or saw a video from the event, you know the uproar was about the overt, and I mean overt, occult symbology that was on display for some of Europe's leading political figures. And now look, I know that sometimes a goat-headed, devil-looking figure being worshipped by a flying baby with wings, an oversized head, and a cast of strange-looking beings is just good, clean fun for a lot of folks, but the recurring use of these unmistakable, and again, let me stress that in the case of the Gotthard Tunnel, the symbology was not hidden. It was really, really in your face. Well, the use of these occult images and themes, particularly in science and in sciencey pop culture, is something that's hard to just brush aside. And at least that's the opinion of today's guest, author and creator of the Secret Sun website, Christopher Knowles.
We saw that Gotthard, Switzerland, tunnel, that weird hour-long ritual that so many people have commented on.
And wait a second, before I play the rest of this clip, let me point out that what's really great about Chris's work is that when he tackles this stuff, he dives deep.
Now, the thing is that people just look at that and just say, oh, that's Satan, that's Lucifer, and blah, 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 blah. And it's like, no, you don't understand what these people are really about. You don't understand, you know, what is really being put across here. You don't understand the God that this goat figure really represents. It's not Satan. It's not Baphomet. It's not Lucifer. It's, you know, a much more, almost more troubling figure in history.
Now, if you're not yet convinced that the gods of Mesopotamia, Egypt, and Greece are really relevant to your life, you might want to take a step back and ask yourself, who does care about such things?
In that same ceremony, we see this woman with this giant baby head and these wings sort of flown in to this tunnel. It's just the weirdest thing. I mean, you just can't believe you're seeing it. It's mind-boggling. But that's actually Eros. That's not Lucifer. These things have specific meanings. They have specific historical context that people overlook because they don't understand. They don't know the history. And if you don't know the history, you don't know what is really being said here, and you don't know what is really being believed here. You know, you don't understand what these people really think.
Okay, but maybe you're still not yet convinced that you should care. Well, let me get all skeptical on you, because as you know, the primary focus of this show has been consciousness science and an attempt to answer the is there more question. Are we more than biological robots in a meaningless universe? Because if you're not more, then you can ignore all this nonsense and chalk it up to crazy stuff that people do to entertain themselves. Or, hey, better yet, if you want to stay kind of sciencey and kind of cutting edge, you can probably lump it into super sci in some way that allows you to sound cutting edge, but at the same time keeps you grounded in some kind of backdoor materialism where you're going to be able to explain it all in rational terms. But if you don't feel comfortable answering the question in quite that way, and if you feel that it's rather obvious that we seem to be embedded in a field of extended consciousness that requires us to consider such things, and may even require us to ask deeper questions like, Are the gods and demons of the Gothard Tunnel in some sense real, or are they a creation of our collective consciousness in some way that we don't understand but we've explored before, like when we talk about the idiosyncratic nature of near-death experiences? That's actually a question I asked Chris in this interview. So what I hear you saying is, yeah, sure, there's some reality to the thought form collective consciousness where we put our attention, we manifest, but we have to balance that if we're going to play this consensus reality game, which says, I see you, you see me, you know, we can observe things and measure things. And even if that isn't totally real, we know that's a little bit less than literally real. We're going to play that game because it's useful. Then you're saying in that same sense, we are obliged to understand the history, understand the context in which these symbols and messages are being communicated. And we can't just chalk it up to this kind of, well, none of it's real anyway. It's all an illusion. It's all a simulation, whatever you want to say, you know, to kind of a diffusion, which is used as kind of a diffusion of responsibility, a personal responsibility that I don't have to really understand it.
No, well, there are two sort of polar opposite reactions. You know, that's one of them. You know, that's sort of the secular mindset that, you know, this is just all nonsense. I don't need to worry about this, blah, 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 blah. Even though this is happening in a government controlled and financed context and setting. So, I mean, if people in the government are paying for this, they're doing so for a reason. They're not just doing it for jollies, you know. But then there's the opposite polar, you know. Maybe it's almost like a, roughly speaking, a left-right polar reaction, you know. So the left secular reaction is like, oh, who cares? It's just nonsense. It doesn't mean anything. And then the right reaction, maybe more religiously oriented, is like, oh, well, that's all Satanist. It's obviously all Satanist. You just dismiss it and say, oh, well, I'm going to make this all about me. I'm going to make this all about my religion, all about my belief system. You're not engaging with what is actually being said.
Stick around. We're about to dive deep into Skeptico with our guest, Chris Knowles. Today we welcome Christopher Knowles to Skeptico. Chris is the author of several books, one that you might have heard of because it drew a huge amount of justifiably positive attention a few years ago, Our Gods Wear Spandex, The Secret History of Comic Book Heroes. Chris also publishes some terrific blog posts and some remarkably extensive series on his site, secretsun.blogspot.com, which, if you've never checked it out, you're in for a fantastic treat. I'll just leave it at that. Chris, welcome to Skepticos. Thanks so much for joining me.
Oh, it's a pleasure and an honor to be here, believe me.
Well, great. It's really great to have you here. I've really enjoyed the email exchanges we've had. You've added so much to my knowledge base, and I was thinking about where to begin. So I actually pulled this right off the front page of your blog. The Secret Sun is a cultural blog dealing with esoteric themes in pop culture and the media. And that's under a heading that reads, part of the reality-based high weirdness community, which has some nice twists and turns right off the bat. Tell folks what you mean, reality-based high weirdness community.
Yeah, that's actually a fictional construct on my part. I'm not sure that the one actually exists, but it was just a way to sort of separate what I was doing from some other things that I was seeing on the net, which were not well-researched, not necessarily cogent, not necessarily well-argued. I mean, I was trying to just sort of distinguish this as that I was actually doing real research, that I was actually using, you know, primary source material, that I was actually, you know, I had experience in the pop culture world.
You know, I really like what you just said, but more than like it, I think it's true. I mean, one of the things I appreciate about digging into your work is that you do seem to have a process that I just really like. I mean, first of all, you're not afraid to take positions that are way out there, counter to the status quo, counter to the officially sanctioned narrative. But then number two, you're not afraid to do the work. I mean, you are a data-driven guy, and you just collect a ton of data, it seems like, on these things. I don't know how you do it. And then finally, one thing that I think is really unique, and I want to talk about all these things, and I want to talk about your process, but you're not afraid to take the "I'm probably wrong on this, but" kind of position. And I love that, because it's like, that's where we wind up, you know, saying, look, one thing I know is what they're telling us is total bullshit. So I don't know if what I figured out is true, but I want you to consider this possibility. That's what I was kind of getting from your process. Do you want to talk about either, you know, your data-driven kind of nature, or this kind of willingness to take some unconventional positions?
Well, I'll take both of those on. As far as the data is concerned, it's interesting, because the amount of data that you see on the blog is usually just sort of the tip of the iceberg of the data that I actually collect and that I read and that I collate and then I process. You know, for instance, when I did the rock book, The Secret History of Rock and Roll, I had a very stringent and sort of restrictive word count as far as, you know, the amount of space that I was able to make my argument. But I actually read like stacks and stacks of books. And even if it necessarily doesn't go directly into the material, as far as I'm pulling quotes or I'm pulling references, it's part of the process. It's part of, you know, familiarizing yourself with a topic as best you can, sort of approaching it from a number of different angles, taking a number of different tacks on it. And, you know, as far as what you're saying is, you know, admitting that I could be wrong. I mean, of course I could be wrong. I could be wrong about everything. I mean, I'm here to make an argument. I'm here to state my case. People can take it or leave it as they will. But, you know, I believe if you make a case strongly enough, and if you're persistent and you research the topic that you're talking about and don't just rely on, you know, say other people who do media analysis of esoterica, for instance. I mean, go back and read books that were published, you know, 100 years ago. That's, things like that are really important, you know, particularly when you're dealing with, you know, ancient culture, religions, and how they influence our pop culture today. Most of the interesting scholarship in my mind was done, you know, in the late 1800s.
Therein lies kind of part of the problem. I mean, how does the average person jump in the middle of your thought stream? And I think it gets back to this reality-based high weirdness community thing on in another way, you know, because if we do go to the weird thing, go, ha ha, I'm weird because I believe in UFOs, and I'm weird because I believe there's a globalist government that wants to control everything. You know, we all wind up saying that sometimes in some places, and we don't really mean it. I mean, a lot of times what I want to say is, I think you're a complete moron if you think Osama bin Laden orchestrated 9/11. I have kind of no pity for you. And I want to ask you about, do you ever feel a certain cynicism for folks who are not willing to kind of jump into your thought stream or do the work? Or how do you process that?
Oh, I absolutely. I totally feel cynical and sometimes despondent. But the thing you have to understand is that I'm competing, you know, you're competing with a behemoth, a media behemoth that works every minute of every day to put forward the official line on any number of topics. And, you know, it becomes more and more restrictive and more Orwellian. So you're competing with that. And you have to understand that the media machine is very good at manipulating people's emotions, particularly their fear. So the way I approach this and the way I approach the work is that, you know, I do a lot of remediation. I repeat the same points a lot because, you know, that's how people learn, is through repetition, is through seeing things, to familiarizing themselves with a topic. So you have to sort of take the same process, you know, in mind, is that people learn through persuasion rather than confrontation. People learn you know, through repetition of ideas and ideas sort of presented cogently and organized and set out for them in a way that they can, you know, even if they're not familiar with my work, you know, I try to, even in every post, even if it's a series, you know, bring people up to speed, because there's always the chance, you know, very good chance that this is the first post that anybody is reading, either of my work or of the argument I'm trying to make. So it's just a question. I mean, I've worked as a graphic artist for 30 years, and I've worked in, you know, editorial. I've worked for magazines. So, I have an understanding of how the media works in a professional mainstream context. So I try to bring some of that knowledge and some of the, you know, the positive ends of propaganda, so to speak, into the work that I do.
Okay, let's break that apart a little bit, because you just talked about the behemoth and you just talked about globalism, really, although you didn't use that word. You use that word plenty on The Secret Sun, and I think a lot of folks who are probably drawn to your work and find a certain affinity to your point of view are probably a little bit shook up when they hear what you have to say about globalism, because it's so stark. I mean, here's one quote that you just said in my email. You said, "This upside-down world of liberals and left defending war, surveillance, and censorship." Here's a longer quote from The Secret Sun. "Globalism and the ubiquity of the media have done a number on civic consciousness, which is really the prime motivator behind movements and groups. I think there was a genuine threat posed by the various Occupy movements for about 5 minutes in 2011, but the powers that be cannily unleashed the social justice warrior virus into the mainstream, which at this writing is well on its way to completely atomizing liberalism and liberal society into countless thousands of hostile nano identities." Again, beautiful. I'm with you 100%. I gotta believe a lot of folks who are kind of in your camp don't really get the globalism thing.
Well, because the way globalism is presented in the media is that it's sort of, you know, this kumbaya, you know, I'd like to buy the world a Coke and drink it in perfect harmony, you know, those advertising memes that are sort of attached to this.
What's wrong with that? I mean, you're right. That's what liberals are drawn to. Aren't we all in this together? Buy the world a Coke. What's wrong with that, Chris?
Well, that's the advertising front. You know, that's the packaging. That's the merchandising. The reality is a lot different. The reality is basically a world of unfettered corporate hegemony, of companies, large corporations, basically being able to do whatever they want without worrying about local law, without worrying about environmental laws, without worrying about monetary laws. Anything that would limit their ability to do whatever they wanted. And also, you know, look at the law of competition and of monopoly. If you have a problem with your local government, you can take it to the state government. If you have a problem with the state government, you can take it to the national government. I mean, if you have this all-consuming international body that is dictating practically every aspect of your life, I mean, who do you appeal to? There's no recourse. There's no appeal. I believe in my politics, you know, are first and foremost anti-authoritarian, but they're also, in a real world, in a real politics sense, based in balance of power, that the, you know, our best bet, our salvation, so to speak, is balance of power of, you know, these monsters that are sort of fighting over our heads, you know, will keep each other busy so we can, you know, go about our business unmolested.
That would be nice. But here's the part I want to push, because I really get the sense that folks don't get it. The progressive liberals don't get it. And it frustrates the crap out of me. It's when you say defending war, surveillance, and censorship. And that's exactly what they've done. I mean, you look at Obama, you know, I voted for Obama. I voted for hope and change and all that stuff. It just evaporated within days after he was first elected. But the record is clear. He was not about anti-war. He was of the biggest war guy. He was right there with Bush. He was about, you know, getting rid of the Fourth Amendment, completely obliterating it, the surveillance state, censorship, the hardest on the whistleblowers in our history of any administration. And yet that just somehow doesn't get through because, oh, he's progressive. I mean, to me, that's the real part of the globalism thing that I feel, I just feel a real sense of desperation that people don't understand what's happening right in front of them.
Yeah, no, I totally agree. I did not vote for Obama the first time he ran because I remember reading that he was backed by, you know, people like Pete Peterson and Warren Buffett. And I said, well, we know how this is going to go. And then I ended up voting for him in 2012 because I had a sort of a list of things that I was really afraid were going to happen if Romney were elected. You know, the expansion of the war in Syria, expansion of economic inequality, expansion of surveillance. I mean, just a laundry list of things that just terrified me. And they all happened anyway. I mean, Obama did what Romney, you know, afraid Romney would do. I mean, and this just to show that, you know, the politics that we have, that we understand, is basically a distraction. It's basically a sideshow. And, you know, as far as people who are on the left, you know, suddenly becoming McCarthyites and, you know, defending surveillance, I mean, again, please understand that these are not people acting out of ill will or out of malice. I mean, these are people who are acting out of fear because they're constantly bombarded with these memes and these themes in the media that, you know, the alt-right is you know, the next step to Kristallnacht, that we're on the verge of a fascist takeover in the United States. I mean, all these straw men and you know, it reminds me of Stalin and the kulaks and the wreckers and, you know, these kind of things that we saw in Soviet Russia. I mean, this is typical, you know, totalitarian propaganda methods of scaring people into supporting things that otherwise they would not. So, I mean, you have to understand, I mean, it's like they're not your enemies. They're not your opponents. They're not your adversaries. I mean, there are people who just tend to see the world differently than you do. And, you know, this goes for conservatives as well. I mean, it's like once you join a club, once you identify yourself in a certain way, it's very easy to be manipulated into supporting things that, you know, are unthinkable in many ways.
Yeah, I think that's really true. To me, that gets back to the cynical thing. And a lot of people reach the point where they go, they've done the research like you have, and they go, gee, that's it. Most people are such total idiots that they just can't handle the truth. So I guess they deserve what they get. I'm not putting those words in your mouth by any means, but I got to wonder if you sometimes feel that way. You know, I sent you a clip from a video just released by Alex Jones, who is about as far from a progressive liberal as you can get. But I thought it was fascinating because it's just him there ranting on this golf course early in the morning. But he's kind of saying that same thing. He's saying, look, you know, I get frustrated. You know, you're all out there. All you want to do is watch football games and, you know, zone out. It's like if you're not willing to face the behemoth, to use your words, if you're not willing to stare down the powers that be and stand your ground, then what good is it? I might as well sell out, cash in, because none of you are going to join me in the fight to begin with. I mean, do you ever get to that point?
Yeah, every time I log on to Twitter. I it's funny because I really don't spend any time at all on Twitter. I just will go on and just sort of see what's being discussed and what's being tossed about. And it's just so far removed from reality. It's astonishing to me. You know, the media has just created this alternative reality that so many people tend to buy into. And, you know, the cynicism, the cynic in me is very much concerned about these things because at the same time, I mean, these, you know, good people, decent people who are being manipulated, and that cuts across ideological boundaries. But at the same time, I kind of feel like you know, something like Antifa, it's like, okay, now we're the thugs, now we're the black shirts, now we're the police, you know, and it's getting off on the power of ganging up, you know, on people who you know, you vastly outnumber on the streets and just beating them up because they have a different position than you do. And then seeing people who defend that because, again, they think that we're just around the corner from the Reichstag fire. So it does get discouraging. It does get disheartening. And sometimes I feel that all you can really do is furrow your own little field and invite people over to join you. Again, you have to understand. I mean, this is the thing that I really understood when I was working in New York and I was going, you know, door to door from these different advertising agencies. You know, these buildings that you see in New York are just filled with like incredibly smart people who work very hard and are paid very well to keep the system going. You know, Alex Jones will get discouraged, but, you know, Alex Jones has to realize that there are all these uncountable NGOs and pressure groups and lawyers committees and things like this. This is their livelihood. I mean, these people are paid very well. They are very well educated and they're constantly working night and day to keep the system going, to maintain the system. And, you know, how do you fight against that? I mean, this is the thing that I've always been, you know, very skeptical about. You know, oh, we've got them on the run. You know, we've got them on the ropes. You know,
right.
You know, this kind of talk, you know, this sort of pro wrestling talk that people like Alex Jones will come up with. And I'm just like, what are you talking about? You have no idea what you're up against.
I totally agree. I always think that, you know, they have not yet begun to fight. I mean, I don't even think we've hit them to where they've really begun to fight, but that's kind of another issue. You know, where where I think that leads us is, you know, part of my process on Skeptico is to kind of sort through this stuff and then try and find the deeper spiritual meaning, whatever those words mean for anyone. I mean, I think that's what we're all about, is trying to find out where this really connects with us on the deepest level. And that is probably what you are best known for, occult and esoteric stuff that you cover again in this way that is extremely, you know, encyclopedic and historical and in this kind of grand sense, which is awesome. First thing I have to ask is, are you comfortable? Do you think that's correct, that that's where you're positioned in a lot of people's minds? And two, are you okay with that, being connected with the esoteric and the occult?
Yeah, I am. As you know, in the limits of my role, I sort of see myself. I mean, there are a lot of people who do, you know, pop culture and esoterica and themes like that, and you know, a lot of them have, you know, much bigger audiences than I do. But, you know, when I look at the work and I look at the things that are being presented, I'm just seeing sort of the same ideas just constantly being recycled. And I know the sources because, you know, I read the sources. I know where all this stuff is originally coming from. What I try to do, you know, and I've done this on Star Trek, you know, the themes and sort of the interesting intelligence people behind Star Trek and things like the Knights Templar and Bell Labs, you know, all these major influences on the future that we're living in now, is I again go back to primary source material, look at the things that other people are not looking at, make arguments that then, you know, that are not being made. You know, for instance, last year I did a major series on the CIA's Project MK Offen. I mean, most people talk about MK Ultra, you know, and MK Ultra is sort of a buzzword. It's sort of shorthand for, you know, MK Search and Bluebird and Artichoke and all these different programs. But I was looking at this one particular program that started in 1966, called MK Offen, and it was basically a program designed to weaponize the occult. And this is a program that not a lot of people are familiar with. And I went back, and there's not a great deal of documentation available on this program. So what I tried to do is, okay, so
can we just interject here for folks who don't know? When you say weaponize the occult, in typical CIA fashion, they were willing to do anything with anybody, right? So we're talking about Satanists, we're talking about all sorts of mediumship. I mean, give people, first of all, a sense of just the kind of shock factor of MK often, and then tell us what you found.
The two are sort of intertwined, because in order to really parse this program out and sort of trace its footsteps, I had to look at the emanations of it, of the, you know, the products of it. So, for instance, as soon as MK often, you know, gets its offices and its name written on the door, I mean, we see the Church of Satan in 1966 in San Francisco. You know, we start to see they worked with a witch from England named Sybil Leek. She starts to make the talk show circuit, you know, Mike Douglas and Merv Griffin and all these big talk shows. You know, this person that nobody had ever heard of before. You know, we start to see the rise of the slasher film. We start to see the rise of really explicit horror. And, you know, I'll give you a couple examples of the footsteps of this and how I believe this worked. Night of the Living Dead is a film that probably a lot of people are familiar with. You know, it's a classic horror film. But not a lot of people realize that that film was premiered to children at a Saturday matinee. Now, Roger Ebert had attended this the screening, and he was just – he couldn't believe what he was seeing. And, you know, he said that, you know, these were very small children, you know, some as old, young as five – who were just being traumatized, who were literally being traumatized. I mean, you know, it went from being sort of a scary William Castle type movie to being real horror, to being, you know, explicit gore. And he was so shocked and outraged that, by this, that he wrote a special column about this. So to me, this is what I see as part of this program. And because think about all the hoops you would have to jump through to get a film that explicit shown in a G-rated matinee. That, you know, there was a Chicago had a board of censors. They had the Catholic Church were very involved in every movie that came out and giving parents guides for them. So a lot of people had to sort of be steered away or paid off or whatever you want to say about how this actually happened. But this is particularly for the time, for that time, late 60s. I mean, this is outrageous. And it can only be deliberate in my mind. It can only be some kind of test. Now, that sounds kind of like a bold claim to make, but let's go fast forward a bit to The Exorcist in 1973. This film, people were reported to, you know, to be vomiting, to be walking out, to be fainting, all these sort of things. You know, it happened in the first run screening of the film, but didn't happen in the second run screening of the film. So what happened? What happened in those intervening years? Well, at the same time The Exorcist was being shown, the military was testing a program called Urban Funk, which was basically subsonics used for crowd control, subsonics used on the battlefield. And the types of reactions that people had to The Exorcist were exactly the types of reactions that the Army had observed in their testing of these subsonic weapons. So you go to a theater, you have a large screen, you have large speakers. It would be the easiest thing in the world to test these kind of weapons, you know, on the public without their knowledge, and no one would be none the wiser. And the interesting thing about this to me is that William Peter Blatty, who wrote the original novel and was involved in the making of the film, was an military intelligence agent before he became a writer. So, you know.
So here's the thing that I think a lot of people have problems with in terms of processing that. And I recently just had a really good interview with Joe Atwell, who is the author of Caesar's Messiah, but is currently working on a book right exactly along these lines about the CIA. And it's not really the CIA, folks, but we'll talk in a minute about what is the CIA and what is this control mechanism.
It's shorthand.
Yeah, it's shorthand for that. It's about debasing culture. And I kept pushing Joe. I go, what do you mean debase? Who? Why don't want to debase culture? And I thought he made a great argument, and maybe you want to kind of fill in the gaps and expound on this, is that it's not debasing culture for the sake of debasing culture. It's debasing culture so that everyone's scared, alone, isolated, and easier to control. I mean, one, do you buy that, or do you think the weaponization of the occult and Satanism and all that has a more direct purpose? Or, I mean, why? Why do all this stuff?
It could be both and. You know, you're dealing with probably a number of different people with a number of different goals. But I agree with Joe in that sense that there obviously is an interest in taking people away from institutions, from organizations, from groups.
Community, right.
Yeah, from community. I mean, things that give people solidarity, that give people a sense of belonging to a greater collective. Because what is clear and what has been in many cases, you know, explicitly spelled out is that we are meant to be, you know, consumers who just basically follow the dictates of the corporate hegemony of the dictatorship of the, you know, the overclass. I mean, whatever you want to call it, but it's, you know, it's that great scene in, and I keep going back to this in Paddy Chayefsky's Network with Ned Beatty playing the
sure.
The CEO of the company that owns the network that the Peter Finch character is on.
I'm mad as hell. I'm not going to take it anymore.
Yeah,
movie,
yeah.
Right?
And his response to that is, you know, you don't understand how the world really works. You know, our goal, our mission is to use money, which is the foundation of all human contact, of all human interaction, to solve the world's problems. You know, you're just getting in the way. And then, you know, we see what happens as a result of that. I think that's the way, you know, these people really think. They, you know, they don't see themselves as the bad guys. They don't see themselves as, you know, super comic book supervillains. They see themselves as, you know, the people who get up every morning at 6 o'clock and work till, you know, past midnight to solve the world's problems for them. And we're just getting in the way. I mean, we are obstacles. And that's, you know, how they think. I mean, I was watching a very interesting Naomi Wolf lecture, and she was talking about how, you know, the corporate overclass really believes that democracy is not only obsolete, but is actually their number one impediment, you know, to making the world a better place in their mind. And this is the thing that I think people really need to realize. And this is what I talk about, you know, the reality-based weirdness community and as far as conspiracy and things like that, is that there's a sort of sense that you get from people, you know, who drift more to that Alex Jones side of the spectrum that, oh, you know, they're doing this to us and they're doing it to me and, you know, they hate me and they're evil and they want to just destroy the world and everything like that. And what they don't understand is that people just, that they're not necessarily motivated by that. I mean, they think that they know what's best for the world, that they know what's best for us, that they know what's best, you know, for the way the world really works. They understand how things work. We don't. We're getting in the way. You know, we're lazy. We're stupid. You know, we're impediments.
And we can understand part of that logic. That's the other thing I always want to kind of throw in there. And that's why I was talking about the cynicism before is I get that. I mean, who the hell is going to run the world? And do we leave the vacuum and do we let the greatest oppressors of history step in that vacuum? Do we let Stalin step in that vacuum? Do we let Mao step in that vacuum? I'm not trying to defend it. I'm just trying to put that on the table and help people understand that you could work yourself into that mindset that people are stupid and they're like cattle and they need to be led. And, you know, what am I going to do?
Well, this is where we get to the deep spirituality that you spoke of. And this is why, you know, I think it's so important. And I think it's sort of important to show how this works in the world. You know, even if you don't necessarily agree or approve of certain strains of deep spirituality, what have you. But really the antidote, you know, sort of starts, the way I work is that everything starts at the bottom. Everything starts at the foundation. I, you know, break things down to their components, break things down to their simplest parts. And I think that you can't operate as a sovereign human being without some sense of spiritual reality. Without that, you know, we see nihilism and just sort of base consumerism, or we see this Satanist movement that's sort of popping up. You know, without a sense of deep spirituality, without a sense of connectiveness, you know, without a sense of even, you know, responsibility of, you know, that this isn't just a collection of consumers, and the world is not just a machine, and the universe is not just this dumb, you know, automata that willed itself into existence somehow that nobody can seem to explain, you know, that we live, you know, that we're part of a community. We're part of a family. We're part of, you know, we live in an environment, which I don't necessarily think we're native to, so to speak, but, you know, that's another discussion, you know, but we live in an environment that is interdependent, that is, that's alive. It's a living thing. You know, there's a great argument to be made that the entire universe is a living being, you know, that the sun has consciousness, that the world, that things we don't necessarily see as conscious because they don't speak to us in linear, literal fashion, that these things actually are alive, that a song, you know, the music has as much meaning as the lyrics. You know, we're very literal. We're very word based. It's a very left brain kind of thing. But, you know, there's a greater sense. There's a greater consciousness. And I think that the way that you really control people is to rob people of that consciousness, or to substitute an ersatz spiritual consciousness. So, I mean, the things I think are all very much intertwined and interdependent, you know, because you can't exist, you know, without the people around you.
You know, and in a way that returns us to the jumping off point for this part of the conversation we've been having when you talked about MK Offen and you talked about the weaponizing of the occult. And I kind of pushed you and I said, hey, is it because it's just, we're going to just try and control people and we'll use whatever we can, or what I was alluding to, is there an attraction to this evil dark forces kind of thing? And I think you very correctly said, I think it's both. And I want you to expound on that a little bit, because you seem to have a healthy respect/caution/fear for the dark forces, for evil, as I do, because I'm not sure what that reality is, but I'm not willing to just kind of take this crazy, secular, atheistic, oh, there's no reality to that, because the evidence just piles up over and over again that there is a reality to it. So when they're doing MK off and they're not just doing control, they're also saying, hey, man, maybe I can tap into that.
Oh, absolutely. And this goes back forever. I mean, really, I mean, this is not anything new. To me, evil as we define it, and there are different theological interpretations of evil. But to the way I perceive evil is a kind of what Scott Peck would call it, you know, a radical selfishness, a sort of almost solipsism writ large, and a lust for power. I mean, we as human beings have, you know, these drives. We have these biological drives that we should strive to control and overcome, but are there nonetheless. And there, we have, you know, dark animalistic impulses. I mean, we're very closely related chimpanzees. We're just brutal, horrible creatures, no matter how you slice it. So I think that
But is there more than that? I mean,
there is. Yeah, there is. I was getting there. I absolutely, I mean, this might disqualify me with, you know, with some of your listeners, but, you know, I absolutely believe in the objective reality of these dark forces, of, you know, of light forces, of neutral forces. I sort of have almost a pantheistic view of reality and the world that we live in. But at the same time, I think that there's a multiplicity of energies, and you know these dark forces are very real, and you don't, you know, we as, you know, modern technologically oriented liberal democratic citizens are, you know, necessarily conditioned against thinking that things have an objective reality. But, you know, I've seen it for myself. I mean, I've seen people who unwittingly even tap into these dark forces and are, you know, physically hurt or killed by them, or, you know, their lives are ruined by them. And it's something that, you know, we tend to dismiss and we tend to chalk up to psychology, but, you know, but I personally don't. I mean, I think psychology plays a part, but I think that evil has a reality. I think it has an objective reality. I believe that good has an objective reality. You know, maybe it's more animistic than pantheistic, but that this is just the way I see the world. I mean, I see that there are currents and, you know, however you want to describe them. I mean, maybe in the future, scientists will understand this, right, and they'll see these all as almost like, you know, the way we see gravity or electricity or, you know, any other sort of force that we don't necessarily visualize or can measure, but we can sense and we can see the footprints of. And to me, you know, evil has a very stark reality. And, you know, just as an example of this, I mean, you know, we're seeing this Satanic Temple group based out of Salem, Massachusetts. This is run by this Harvard graduate. And there's sort of.
I don't think he graduated, but did he graduate or just attend?
I'm not sure. I know he was like, people like Richard Dawkins seemed to be very interested in this guy when he was an undergraduate.
And what's his name again? Graves?
Yeah, Lucian Graves. His real name is Doug Messner. And, you know, he seems to be very, very interested in getting the Satanic Temple installed in elementary schools, for example. I mean, it's mind-boggling, and they're very interested in children for some reason. I mean, we won't go there, but they're insinuating themselves. They think, no, this is just, you know, we don't really actually believe in Satan. You know, this is just a philosophical society. You know, we're just atheists and rationalists and skeptics and on and on and on. And then you go to their temple in Salem, and it looks like Anton LaVey's worst fever dreams. It's just, you know, it's unbelievable. So it's like, you know, this is sort of the way, it's like, you know, you tell people, you know, I'm not, you know, let me have the key to your house. You know, I'm not going to steal all your stuff. I'm not going to steal all your stuff. I'm not going to steal your stuff. And then you come home and it's like all your stuff is gone. And they're just like, well, what'd you expect? It's sort of like the scorpion and the frog.
Exactly. And it's from someone who says, look, my basic ethos is that I will lie, cheat, steal, do what I have to serve my interest, because that's how I think the world works. Now, given that you know that, give me your key. I mean, you know, really, I mean, that's their stated kind of do what thou wilt kind of value system. They're upfront about it. But then, yeah, people are somehow bamboozled into thinking it's not going to happen to them.
Well, it's the power of propaganda. You know, they're very good at propaganda. And, you know, they present themselves as, you know, this sort of benevolent, self-sacrificing, you know, think tank or something. But then, you know, you see their promotional videos and it's like, you know, a horror movie. It's just, it's disturbing. And they use all the iconography and the very disturbing undercurrents that, you know, we necessarily associate with Satan. And, you know, to people who buy the line, who buy the propaganda line. I mean, it's like, you know, once you, you know, identify yourself with Satan or with any powerful spiritual force, whether for good or evil, I mean, you're playing on their field, you know. And again, some of your listeners might just think this is, you know, insanity and delusion and primitive thinking, but this is the way I think. It's like, once you put yourself into this context, you know, when you, take on the uniform and you take on the garb of systems that are older than your great, 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 great grandparents, you know, that were perfected thousands of years ago, you are going to play their game, whether you like it or not. And you may not see it at first, but eventually it's going to, you know, it's like your hair growing. You know, you don't notice your hair growing, but all of a sudden, you know, you wake up one morning, you're like, oh, crap, I need a haircut. So it's like, this is how it works. It's, you know, a process of insinuation.
That's really, really powerful stuff. And I take it even in a different direction that reinforces it in another way. And that's that, you know, if you're sitting at your desk, at your corner office at DynCorp, and you're engaged in all sorts of horrible child sex trafficking and throw parties with all this abhorrent sex crimes against children kind of thing, and you're saying, hey, man, I'm still getting that check from the CIA and I'm still connected to, you know, the movers and the shakers, and you think you're not somehow being connected and tuned into that same energy, even though you're not wearing the pentagram upside down, and even though you're not doing all the rites and rituals, you're still being channeled into that same energy. What are your thoughts about that?
Well, I would take it even a step further, and I'll tell you why. I mean, I'm from the Boston area. I grew up in the 70s. You know, people who've seen the film Spotlight, the Oscar winning film starring Michael Keaton and Liev Schreiber and so on.
About the Catholic priest exploitation of children expose and how that made its way into the media. Please go ahead.
Yes, exactly. I mean, so here's the thing. I mean, in the town I grew up in, it's called Braintree. You know, and I wrote about this on the blog, that we had a situation where there was a teacher who had been at this junior high school that I went to for 22 years, who was an open pedophile. I mean, he was open. Everyone in the school knew what was going on. Everyone in the school knew who he had in his little harem or his little stable. Everyone knew that, you know, if you went along with this guy, that you'd get like mini bikes and stereos and new clothes and everything like that. I mean, this guy had access to amounts of money that no junior high school teacher should have possibly had access to. And this was going on. I mean, like I said, he taught there for 22 years. He was finally arrested in 1980. But everyone knew what was going on. Everyone knew what was happening. How is this allowed to go on? How is this allowed to continue? You know, there were parents who complained that they were all sort of brushed off by the teachers. We, you know, in this town I grew up in, we have a notoriously corrupt police department. And when this guy was finally arrested, he was arrested on his 52-foot cabin cruiser off the state of Florida. Now, I don't know if you know about teacher salaries in the 1970s for junior high teachers, but, you know, they really weren't guys who could cut buying a 52-foot cabin cruiser, you know, I mean, which is going to run you anywhere from like $500,000 to $1 million today. So this guy was obviously, you know, in my mind, was was feeding these kids into some other, you know, stream, some other system that was going on. But at the same time, I mean, you had basically, you know, a pedophile cult running the Archdiocese of Boston. You know, and interestingly enough, the Archdiocese of Boston is now located in Braintree, is located in the town I grew up in. They moved from Boston to Braintree. You know, the so-called Nambler priest, Paul Shanley, you know, started his career in Braintree. He opened up what was called the Pilgrim Youth Center, which was eventually very quietly sort of closed down. You know, there are all these things going on. And people know the story and people can read the story. I mean, you had, I think, 271 priests that were either accused or convicted. So, you know, this is evil. I mean, they are using their position as spiritual leaders of the community to prey upon children. This is objectively evil. This is, you know, doing the devil's work, so to speak. So even if you are operating under the guise of, you know, you're preaching mass on Sunday and, you know, you're doing good works, you know, soup kitchens and things like that, but you're also raping children. So there's no ideological or moral justification that can be made for that. you might not think that you're doing evil, but if you're actually doing evil, you are serving evil, in my mission.
You know, you touched on something there a minute ago that I don't want to let pass, because it's one place clearly where my work in Skeptico overlapped with something you had discovered. And I was really surprised when I discovered it. And if I would have been a more regular reader of The Secret Sun, I probably would have caught on to it much sooner. But, you know, here I am doing parapsychology research, recapping and understanding and trying to interview both sides. And I keep running into this kind of crazy Satanism friendly, safe space Satanism, you call it. You know, when I run into this guy, Richard Wiseman, who's this big skeptic, but is kind of one of the most prominent psychology educators in the UK and in all the news. And he's saying, you know, hey, man, come to the Edinburgh Secret Society. It's cool. We're all atheists, but we like to dress up in devil costumes and do all this stuff. You know, it's all okay, though, right? Because we're all atheists, right? And then I saw that you had explored the same topic in your blog post, Safe Space Satanism. So, and in this case, you were talking, I think, about the Detroit Satanic Temple, but it could have been any other places where this has popped up. Tell us about Safe Space Satanism, its connection to atheism, its strange connection to atheism and scientific materialism. Tell us about that.
Well, it's almost like a 70s big-haired fundamentalist worst nightmare come true, you know, that atheism will lead to nihilism, which, you know, leads to Satanism. It's sort of like the old, you know, shock the bourgeoisie idea that you saw in the late 19th century, you know, sort of starts with the Romantics. It's this idea that, you know, it's just a LARP. It's just dress up. It's just play acting. You know, we're going to go through the motions. We're going to just sort of, you know, immerse ourselves in satanic lore and satanic grimoires. But, you know, we're not really Satanists. You know, it's to me, it's how do I put this? You know, what's the metaphor that I can draw here? You know, it's sort of like you start off drinking, you know, non-alcoholic beer, but, you know, having beer parties with non-alcoholic beer, you sort of, it's almost like, to me, it seems to me, you know, and people are going to take exception to this. It seems to me like a rehearsal for the real thing. It's a way of insinuating people, you know, that's why I call it safe space Satanism. You know, it starts off in a safe space. It starts off in a, oh, you know, this is just pretend. We're just play acting. And you're right. I mean, this is so prevalent in the kind of circles that we run in, or at least on the margins of them. And to me, it's just like, you know, these symbols have power. These things, I sense this. I've always sensed this. I've always saw these symbols, and it's like they have an innate power of their own. You know, you can't play with these symbols. Like I said before, you can't play with them without playing their game. I mean, you know, they're on their field. Sort of like this way of like, oh, we're going to be shocking. You know, maybe a lot of these people had religious upbringings, fundamentalist upbringings. You know, I'm not sure. But it's kind of a way of dipping your toes into the water, in my estimation.
And I wonder if they're really not trying to go a lot further. And I sent you a YouTube video from a special report from our friends at CNN done by Lisa Ling, and she's reporting on the same thing, the Detroit Temple. But I love this little clip in there where she goes, you know, oh, they're the rational guys, and they're just trying to stave off these crazy Christians who admittedly are crazy Christians. But then I love this line where she goes, for security reasons, attendees are required to sign a pact with the devil. And there they have it.
Yeah.
These folks are lined up around the block and they say, okay, if you want to come in, sign right here, sign your soul away from the devil so we can make sure you're not one of those crazy Christians. And you're thinking, you know, they I'm sure that no one planned this whole thing, because you never would. But whoever came up with this is an evil genius, right? Because now, whether there's this reality to it, like you're talking about, like I believe there is and you believe there is, or if there's just the psychological traumatization that would come with signing something like that. Either way, it's a win for those guys.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. I absolutely. And yeah, I totally agree with you about that. That whole thing, that clip that you refer to. It reminds me of the remake, and it's actually a very good film. I think it tends to get overlooked, but the remake of Bedazzled, the Harold Ramis made a remake with Brendan Fraser and Elizabeth Hurley. I thought it was very well done, and she does sort of the same thing. She's sort of luring Brendan Fraser into selling a soul, and she's like, "Oh, what's a soul? You know, does it even exist? You know, it's like, oh, well, you know, who cares? You know, you don't really believe in that thing anyway. You know, but it's like I said, I mean, the iconography of Satanism. I mean, even just these warning colors, the black and red they use. I mean, they have a very specific psychological effect. And I think by immersing yourself in, this imagery and this iconography, I think it has, it changes your consciousness. And, you can see it in that way. You could also see in the way that I argued before that there is an objective reality to this. But either way, it cuts to the same thing and it has the same results. Listen, we saw all this before. We saw this in the 70s. We saw this in the 60s even. You know, Anton LaVey said, I'm just doing Ayn Rand with capes. That's how he sort of sold it to the people. And then 4 or 5 years later, you're seeing satanic murders all across the United States. People say, well, those didn't happen. Well, no, in fact, they did. And you can say, well, they're not really Satanists. It's like, well, they thought they were Satanists. Maybe they weren't officially affiliated with Anton LaVey or Michael Aquino or whoever you, but they saw themselves as Satanists. They saw what they were doing as doing the work of Satan. So it's like this, and then it happened, because Marilyn Manson came along 20 years later, or 30 years later, whatever, he's sort of spouting the same line, it's like, oh, I'm not really into Satan. I'm against Christian fundamentalist dogma, and I'm a rationalist. And then a few years later, we start seeing, satanic murders. I mean, it's inevitable. I always say, you don't have to worry about like the people, in Portland or San Francisco or New York, sort of bourgeois bohos, right. You don't have to worry about them. You have to worry when it filters down into the trailer parks. You have to worry when it filters down into, the housing projects, because the same process has happened over and over again. And it's like, when are we going to learn? I mean, it happened in the Middle Ages, people like Bluebeard. So it has the same results. It always plays out the same way. It always goes really bad. People always get hurt. People always get killed. And it all starts with, oh, we don't really mean this. We're not really worshiping Satan, blah, 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 blah. The romantic poets, saw Satan as this like liberatory figure, the figure of the Enlightenment and things like that. But it always plays out the same exact way. And I keep telling people this and they keep, it's like, well, what's the matter with Chris? I mean, has he gone off the deep end? Is he all of a sudden a fundamentalist? It's like, no, I've always thought this. I've always said this. I've always seen this. I've always observed this. It's like my opinion is based on data. Your opinion is based on the press.
That's an important point. Let me jump in there because I don't want people to get the wrong impression, the impression that you just articulated right there. And maybe what I'd point people to, and we can shift to, is the excellent series you did on Lucifer's technologies. Because there you take really kind of a different position. You go, you get the data, and Lucifer kind of slips through the fingers and disappears from as a historical basis. I mean, you really do a deconstruction there that I think is helpful in trying to understand that whole thing on a number of different levels. And then you come to some other different conclusions about technology and stuff like that. So maybe you want to tackle that as best you can in trying to summarize a book length post that spanned multiple posts, and it's impossible to summarize it, but just both how maybe Lucifer isn't this figure that we think he is, and then number two, what that really means from a technology standpoint and how that concept has been kind of used.
Well, I'm glad you asked that, because I've always seen, in conspiracy theory to this day, this whole thing about Luciferians, these people are Luciferians, they worship Lucifer, and Lucifer does this and Lucifer does that.
And Lucifer is always positioned as this kind of Satan light kind of figure, you know, the light bearer, misunderstood, not necessarily a good guy, but, you know, complex. And then, so I'm sorry, go ahead.
Having studied Christianity and the history of religion, you know, I understood that the whole thing of Lucifer really comes from, you know, Lucifer as Satan comes from misinterpretations of two passages in the Old Testament. You know, one is in Isaiah, and I think one's in the book of Daniel. But, you know, they're descriptions of Babylonian kings, you know, who are seen as, you know, these very lofty, almost godlike figures who God will strike down because, you know, our God is the best God and he's better than your God, so on and so forth. So, but this whole idea of Lucifer, it's like, well, Jesus is called Lucifer in certain, you know, the Vulgate, for instance. And there's actually a, what was a very widespread Catholic mass, Latin mass, identifies Christ with Lucifer. And, you know, of course, we know about Lucifer being the description of Venus, and the morning star and things like that. But I was really interested in, you know, how did this evolve? How did this happen? And it happened in a very interesting fashion because there was a very influential and powerful figure in the early Christian movement called Saint Jerome. And Saint Jerome had an ongoing battle with this very hardcore fundamentalist Christian sect called the Luciferians. And this is actually historically true. I mean, you know, when you trace back to who the Luciferians actually were, they were basically, you know, the religious right of their time. They were very dogmatic, extremely hardcore. You know, Jerome had this whole notion of, you know, forgiveness of sins and things like that, that the Luciferians just wanted nothing to do with. I mean, they were, you know, your worst religious right nightmare.
The what's the group, the Baptist group in
like Westboro Church.
Yeah, the Westboro Church of the time. Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, that's exactly who they were. So St. Jerome was so annoyed by them that he started to insinuate Lucifer into these passages in the Bible. And it was just sort of like a little dig. And he probably didn't think it was really going to, you know, go anywhere, but it's just his way of just sort of striking back at them. And it was not saying that, you know, they were Satanists, but that they were haughty, that they thought they were better than everyone else, you know, that they would be struck down by God because for, you know, for their pride and things like that. So the way this plays out is that people who come later sort of interpret that as, oh, he must mean Satan. You know, because with the rise of the church, when the church became a political construct, you know, a political construct needs an in-group and an out-group. So we started to see the rise of this whole idea of, you know, that there are these Satanists and these Luciferians that are working to undermine the church. And this grows and grows till we see the medieval grimoires where, you know, Lucifer is, you know, a prince of hell. This is what I'm saying. You got to go back to original sources. You got to go back to the history, you know, trace this back. And what Lucifer really is based on a Middle Eastern god, the mythology of which is that it's almost like the myth of Icarus, where he, you know, he challenges the sun, but the sun overcomes him, you know. And this is a description of Venus, the morning star, you know, seeming to rise on the horizon before the sun, you know, as an imitation of the sun, but the sun overpowers it as it rises and gains in strength. So, you know, that's where that mythology comes from, where, you know, Lucifer is, which is all non-biblical, by the way. I mean, this entire history that people assume is in the Bible because people don't read their Bible is actually not in the Bible. You know, there's nothing about this in the Bible, you know, identifying Lucifer with Satan and the morning star and blah, 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 blah. I mean, it's entirely extra biblical. And like I said, I mean, in the Vulgate, Jesus is called Lucifer. So what I did is I just kept, you know, going farther back and farther back. And I just, you know, was going back thousands and thousands of years. And what Lucifer really draws back to is sort of almost like a constellation of Sumerian, Akkadian, and Babylonian fire gods. Who and this is very interesting too, is that they were like the patron gods of a brickmakers, you know, masons, you know, the people who build the ziggurats. They were patron gods of jewelry makers. They were patron gods of craftsmen. You know, because so many crafts have to do with using fire, you know, fire being the great technology of the time, sort of fire being the internet of the time. So, you know, the fire gods became associated not only with technology, and that's, you know, why I use the term Lucifer's technology, but they also came associated with like secret oaths, because all these guilds kept their trade secrets secret. I mean, you know, you didn't go around telling everybody how you made a certain kind of brick that wouldn't melt in the rain, because that was your trade secret. So they became associated with secret societies, with secret oaths, with people who had an inordinate amount of power in the power structure of the time, because, you know, the kings would be very reliant on these people who are, you know, basically the Silicon Valley of their day. And they, you know, it's like Apple. You know, Apple is notoriously secretive. It's notoriously punitive to people who reveal any secrets. And these groups were the exact same way. So this all just, you know, through corruption and through traveling around, it tends to grow and become associated in the present mind with, you know, the overclass, with the overlords and Luciferianism, you know. And it's like, I very strongly believe, I mean, if you actually look at the symbolism that we see in New York and Los Angeles and London, and you know, there is a very specific theology, let's say, attached to that. But, you know, it's not Satanist. It's not Luciferian, unless you sort of argue those philosophies out of their original context. You know, it has to do with power. It has to do with, you know, being the lordship of heaven and whatnot. But it's a much different ideology. It's a much different philosophy. So basically what this all boils down to is that Lucifer, as we understand him, is almost like a ghost. He's almost like a figure that we associate with certain things for, you know, particular reasons, and reasons that are based in historical fact. But it almost sort of takes on a life of its own.
Let me pick up on that, a life of its own thing. And I love the way you put it, argue them out of their philosophical and historical context, which maybe we ought to. To what extent are you open to the idea that these are somehow thought forms that are evolving and energizing and re-energizing based on what we put into them? Because, like I shared with you in the email, Richard Smalley, the biblical scholar, does a really extraordinary job of kind of deconstructing Satan in some of the same ways that you are. And he goes back to some of the very, very old Jewish stories, kind of pre-Torah, where it's the same story told with Yahweh being the good guy and the bad guy. And then all of a sudden the story switches and there's this kind of Zoroaster influence. And hey, we need a bad guy in the story. Let's not make Yahweh play both roles here. Let's introduce this other figure, Satan. And kind of what I maintain or am open to is the idea that so it doesn't make any difference. If you take all that negative energy and you attach it to Satan or you attach it to Lucifer, it takes on a certain life of its own. And I would say the same is true with Jesus. You're more inclined to be open to the historical Jesus. I'm not quite sure that that really holds up. But in any case, I'm certainly inclined to agree that Christ consciousness and this goodness comes through over and over and over again. It's undeniable. So it's a long kind of rant there to get back to this point that I think I'm building off of your point. How much of this might be thought forms that are really being created by the energy we put into them?
I agree with that. I absolutely agree with that. And like I said, the reason I use the term Lucifer's technologies is that I'm drawing this parallel to how technology started off as something that was liberating and freeing and almost inevitably becomes weaponized, almost inevitably becomes used against us, you know, surveillance and drones and things like this. I mean, this increasing technocratic state that, you know, you could argue is very much Luciferian in the original context. I mean, you can very much see this as a Luciferian construct, because the Luciferians, as they were originally understood, were very powerful groups that controlled technology. So I think in that context, it's a very apt description. You know, the problem that I was having is that Luciferian was sort of described as this finite, self-identified group, and they're not. It's basically a term that we use to, you know, as shorthand. Again, you're using the shorthand to describe technology starting off as a liberating force and becoming an enslaving force. And that's exactly, you know, what I'm trying to argue in that series.
And I think you argue it extraordinarily well. Again, how many posts are in that series? How many words? I mean, it's like a book.
I think there are 12 parts. And then I wanted to delve into this, the historicity of these fire gods, these Babylonian fire gods. So I think there was another four installments. Yeah. So it basically is a book. And you know, that's why I did the blog. It's because I've always had such frustrations with publishing and limitations and, you know, that certain ideas aren't necessarily sellable as books, but they're ideas that I think are really valid, you know, and they're new. It's new. It's a new way of looking things, and publishers don't necessarily like that. You know, let's get back to this whole idea of these constructs. I think that as far as it goes, you know, as far as, you know, describing evil in terms of Satan, to describing, you know, technological control as Luciferian, I mean, I think that these are very useful shorthands as far as they are. But I haven't blogged in this yet, but I really want to explore this with you just a little bit, because I keep seeing, you know, we saw that Gothard, Switzerland, that tunnel, that weird hour-long ritual that so many people have commented on. Now, the thing is that people just look at that and just say, oh, that's Satan, that's Lucifer, and blah, 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 blah. And it's like, no, you don't understand what these people are really about. You don't understand, you know, what is really being put across here. You don't understand the God that this goat figure really represents. It's not Satan. It's not Baphomet. It's not Lucifer. It's, you know, a much more, almost more troubling figure in history, you know, that we know as Jupiter Amon. And Jupiter Amon is a syncretic blending of, you know, the sky god Jupiter and Egyptian god Amon or Amun, you know, later syncretized with the sun god Ra and whatnot. I mean, these things all sort of coalesce and mix up and change roles and things like that. If you look at ritual and, you know, the specific symbols and the way they're constructed and the way that they're laid out, you really understand that this is like what I, for shorthand, I call this the hidden god. This is the hidden god that we see, you know, on the dollar bill. People say, oh, that's Lucifer, that's Satan, that's Horus. No, it's, you know, we see it right there in the quote, Anuit Keptus. You know, he has favored our undertakings. That comes from a poem written by Ovid about Jupiter, but in fact is really about this, you know, and we see it in the Egyptian context, it's about the syncretic god, you know, this mixing of these supreme gods. And this is something that I'm going to explore further on in the blog, so I don't want to, you know, let the cat out of the bag too much. But for instance, when we see this in that same ceremony, we see this woman with this giant baby head and these wings sort of flown in to this tunnel. It's just the weirdest thing. I mean, you just can't believe you're seeing it. It's mind-boggling. But that's actually Eros. That's not Lucifer. That's not, you know, whoever it's described at in these YouTube videos. It's Eros. You know, these things have specific meanings. They have specific historical context that people overlook because they don't understand. They don't know the history. And if you don't know the history, you don't know what is really being said here, and you don't know what is really being believed here. You know, you don't understand what these people really think, the way that, you know, I mean, I don't know exactly who is responsible for this, but obviously people in power signed off on this. Obviously people in influential positions signed off on this. And, you know, this just didn't happen. You know, some weird art troupe didn't just wander into the tunnel and say, oh, well, you're here for this dedication, why don't we put on this little show for you, like some sort of bit of guerrilla theater, you know? That's not how it happened. It was, you know, a lot of people signed off on it, people in positions of power, probably people in Brussels, people in the EU. So this is what I'm trying to say. It's like you need to understand what these people are really saying. And if you just say, oh, this is all satanic or this is all Luciferian, you miss the point. And if you miss the point, you're not going to really be empowered to react to it.
You know, that's a really good point, too, because I understand where you're going with that in terms of a counterbalance with the thought form thing, because so what I hear you saying is, yeah, sure, there's some reality to the thought form, collective consciousness, where we put our attention, we manifest, but we have to balance that if we're going to play this consensus reality game, which says, I see you, you see me, you know, we can observe things and measure things. And even if that isn't totally real, we know that's a little bit less than literally real. We're going to play that game because it's useful. Then you're saying in that same sense, we are obliged to understand the history, understand the context in which these symbols and messages are being communicated. And we can't just chalk it up to this kind of, well, none of it's real anyway. It's all an illusion. It's all a simulation, whatever you want to say, you know, to kind of a diffusion, which is used as kind of a diffusion of responsibility, a personal responsibility that I don't have to really understand it.
No, well, there are two sort of polar opposite reactions. You know, that's one of them. You know, that's sort of the secular mindset that, you know, this is just all nonsense. I don't need to worry about this, blah, 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 blah. Even though this is happening in a government controlled and financed context and setting. So, I mean, if people in the government are paying for this, they're doing so for a reason. They're not just doing it for jollies. And, you know, it's not just for giggles and grins. But then there's the opposite polar, you know, maybe it's almost like a, roughly speaking, a left-right polar reaction, you know. So the left secular reaction is like, oh, who cares? It's just nonsense. It doesn't mean anything. And then the right reaction, maybe more religiously oriented, is like, oh, well, that's all Satanist. It's obviously all Satanist. It's Satanism, you know, blah, 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 blah. You know, I
have the sole way of understanding it. It's based on my version of this book, and any other interpretation is not valid.
Yeah. And well, see, there are two problems with that. First of all, there's the illusion, you know, that you can counteract this spiritually. But here's the problem. I mean, if you're counteracting it spiritually and you're just describing it as Satan, it's not Satan. You know, it doesn't work that way. It's not the same set of symbols. It's not the same arguments being made. So if you're going to react to it in a spiritual context, in a spiritual sense, shouldn't you at least understand, you know, what argument is being made first? You know, if you just dismiss it and say, oh, well, I'm going to make this all about me. I'm going to make this all about my religion, all about my belief system. You're not engaging with what is actually being said. Now, I'm certainly not saying that you need to agree with it in any way, shape, or form, but you need to understand it. You know, you need to understand what's going on. And this is like a problem that we saw, you know, like the ugly American, you know, this whole idea that Americans would go abroad and would not bother to understand the culture that they're visiting and just sort of run around and puff their chests up and say, you know, I'm number one, I'm the boss, and just created this enormous amount of resentment all over the world towards Americans because of the way people, you know, obviously the military or intelligence agencies, but obviously, you know, the way these tourists sort of would not want to understand the culture they were visiting, would not want to engage with the culture on its own terms, would just sort of try to be very pushy and just impose their cultural context on, you know, a place that they're visiting, which is, you know, it's the height of arrogance. And if you don't understand the culture that you're in contact with, if you don't understand how they think, you know, not only is that going to lead to pointless waste of energy as far as aggression and anger, but it's also going to disempower you, because if these people are actually acting against you, shouldn't you understand, you know, the way they think? Shouldn't you understand the way they see the world, the way they understand the world? And that's really a large part of what I'm trying to do in the blog, and I've tried to do since the very beginning, is say, no, stop and wait. Understand that these symbols have meanings. They have specific meanings. They have specific historical context. That these people understand these symbols better than you do. That these people have studied these symbols, you know, better than you have. So, you know, when you look at, like, these buildings that you're using all this symbolism, you know, the great example that I used in the beginning of the blog was the World Financial Center, which the roofs of which spell out the Sirius glyph, you know, in geometric fashion. Now, so what does Sirius mean to them? You know, you might say, oh, that's just the devil. But, you know, that's not what it means to them. You know, if you don't understand what it means to them, you have no way of offering a coherent counter argument to that. So you need to understand what they're saying first. You know, you need to understand what these rituals really mean, not what you want them to mean. And that's what I think is the problem with so much of the kind of pop culture interpretation that I see out there. It's like what you want it to mean rather than what it's really saying, because they don't want to do the homework. They want to just, you know, listen to William Cooper radio shows and just sort of say that counts as research. That doesn't count as research. You know, you've got to do actual research. You've got to go back and read, you know, foundational texts. You've got to see what these the arguments being made by, you know, Freemasons and Rosicrucians, you know, all this. You know, you could argue that this symbolism has all been weaponized, but this is the symbolism you're dealing with. You have to understand, you know, what this goes back to, what these people are really saying. If you don't understand what they're really saying, you have no way of reacting to it effectively.
Well, that's maybe a good place to end this session. Like I said at the beginning, I knew we weren't going to be able to cover everything I wanted to cover, because folks, there's so much more in all of Chris's books that we haven't even, many that we just haven't even mentioned. And I'm going to ask Chris in a minute to do that. But first, I'm going to just insist that you come back on maybe in a couple months and we can pick up where I left off on all these notes. You have so many great ideas and interesting thoughts on pop culture, but also on technology that we just barely touched on, and transhumanism, and also on other conspiracy theories, the UFO subject and aliens, something we just didn't even touch on, and as a whole island. It's really not an island. It's a connected, it's an island in that it's connected under the water, but it appears to be an island kind of thing. So there's a lot more to talk about. It's just been great having this conversation with you. Tell folks more about some of your other books that are most popular and people would find interesting. And then you've already kind of tipped your hand a little bit on what's coming up on The Secret Sun. But if there's anything else you want to tell people about, please do that.
Well, the one-stop shopping place is secretsun.blogspot.com. And as far as books, I have, three major works out. One is Are Gods Wear Spandex? The Secret History of Comic Book Heroes. The Secret History of Rock and Roll, which is deals with the ancient mysteries and the way they reinvented themselves as rock and roll, classic rock particularly, and also The Complete X-Files, which is a beautiful, large coffee table book with tons and tons of pictures from The X-Files. And, I wrote the text on the seasons, and, anybody who's interested in or a fan of The X-Files would just absolutely love this book. And, you know, Christmas season is coming up, so it makes a great holiday gift as well. So, those are three. I mean, I have so many. I have a novel that I've written a first draft on that deals with some of these themes in a fictional context. And as soon as I'm done with my day job work, I hope to get back to that. But, there's a lot of stuff coming up. I have a lot of material in the backlog on The Secret Sun. So just bookmark it, and there'll always be interesting stuff to read.
Great. I'll be there. I'll be reading. You've totally won me over. So, Chris, thanks again for joining me on Skeptico.
Thank you very much, Alex.
Thanks again to Chris Knowles for joining me today on Skeptico. I have a ton of questions to tee up from this interview, but I'm going to limit it to one, and then I may find another way to kind of work these questions in through some YouTube videos. I got some ideas I'm kind of working on in the background. But here's the question to start with. What do you make of Chris's basic premise? And that is that there is occult as in hidden and as in esoteric symbology all over the place in our culture. And we see it in our pop culture, kind of a bad term, but in our mass media culture, in movies and TV shows and books. And we also see it in government agencies. We see it in NASA emblems that they wear on their sleeve. We see it on the dollar bill, or we see it in buildings and kind of stuff like that. And so now, however far you want to take that, I mean, some people obviously take it too far. But I mean, Chris's point is that it's so obvious, it's so blatant, like in the example that we gave at the beginning, that it's impossible to deny that some of it is going on. But of course, there's a lot of people who think it's all just crazy stuff. So What do you think? Do you think it's real? To what extent do you think it is exaggerated or not important? Or related to that is, what do you think is behind it? If you accept that the symbology is there, why, who's doing it, and why are they doing it, kind of thing. Okay, there, I already teed up a bunch of questions, and it's really only one question. There's a lot more stuff to get to from this interview, and that's why I enjoyed so much talking with Chris today. Of course, if you have some thoughts or ideas on this, I'd love for you to join me in the Skeptico Forum. I know forums are a little out of date for people, but I just don't find a better way for a small group of people to get together and really dig into talking about these issues. So I always enjoy the conversations that go on in the forum. I'm always over there. If you do want to connect with me or talk with me or ask me a question, I'm there on the Skeptico Forum, so do check that out if you want. Of course, if you find another way to reach me, that's fine too. You know, Facebook, email, whatever. Anyways, please do that. Please connect to the show. Share the show with other people. Let other people know. The show has been kind of, it goes through these ups and downs, but it's kind of on a surge now where there's more and more people listening and more new people coming into the show, which is cool, great. Always love to see it. Love sharing all this information, and especially finding other like-minded people to connect with, because as we know, that's sometimes tough to do. Anyways, all that is out there. I have plenty more Skeptico coming. I can't get away from it. It keeps pulling me back in, and that's a good thing. Until next time, take care, and bye for now.